Tales from Life on the Road, the Experiences of a Long-Haul Trucker. There are more than 3 million truckers on the roads of America, and one thing you learn from Finn Murphy's new book is that they are not all the same. There are hierarchies and subcultures within the trucking industry. There is also the lingo. For example, if a trucker says that he or she got a haircut, that's not a good thing. It means that he or she had an unfortunate encounter with a low bridge. If he's referred to as a bedbugger, that means he's a mover. Finn Murphy is a bedbugger. His handle is U-Turn. And he dropped out of Colby College for his life on the road. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we meet Finn Murphy and hear some remarkable tales of that life. Do you have trucking stories to share? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. America's truck drivers are on the road every day of the year in all kinds of conditions, moving everything we use, from furniture and food to propane and machine parts. The trucking industry is its own world. And now a first-time author is giving the rest of us a window into that world. Finn Murphy grew up in Connecticut, attended Colby College, and now lives in Colorado. He started working as a long-haul trucker in 1980. He is the author of the new book, The Long Haul, and he joins me here in our studio. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about the life of a truck driver? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Finn, welcome back to Maine.
Hi, Jennifer. Great to be here.
I think that this is a first for Maine Calling, the first time that a guest has arrived for the show driving a tractor trailer truck. So I want to know, do you have your truck on a book tour, or are you doing appearances for your book tour in between gigs?
Yeah, I can't do it between gigs because the schedule is just so hard. So, I'm on a book tour. This is the 42nd state that I've been in. I've been out on the road now a few months. I've been to almost 60 bookstores. I've got a book event tonight at Print, a bookshop in town. And I've got 3 more left, and then I get to go home.
But where's home?
Boulder, Colorado.
And how long will you be there?
I don't know. that's the form of this whole thing.
Well, one thing I learned from your book is that it's kind of dangerous to drive around with an empty truck. Is your book tour trouble?
No, it's dangerous out west. Say in Wyoming, when you have the high winds, it's actually a little bit easier to drive an empty truck. Because I don't have to shift as many gears, and acceleration and deceleration is easier.
Okay, so it's in the mountain passes where it's harder, but
yeah,
otherwise it's easier.
The high plains.
All right. So you've been on the road as a trucker for a long time, but you didn't exactly have an auspicious start. And I love the story of your very first couple of days in the trucking biz. Can you share that?
Yeah, I work as a mover. I work for a van line. And I started as a local mover in summer semesters between college. Remember when we used to have jobs instead of internships? Well, my parents thought it'd be a great idea to do a little manual labor. And, of course, they had no clue that I would be seduced by that and become my career. So I started working as a local mover, and I was very bad at it, and I was really nervous. And I actually fell through the sheetrock ceiling of an attic on my first day. And I burned up my boss's car by leaving it running. But I didn't get fired.
I was going to say, he didn't fire you. What a nice guy.
I think that's because anybody who was willing to do this moving kind of work, I think they're welcome, even if they're not entirely competent.
You're a high-end mover now at the top of the food chain for truckers. Something else I learned from your book. I didn't know there was this food chain. But I think many of us see the tractor trailers on the road and have no idea that there's this hierarchy out there and that pay can vary so wildly from one kind of truck driver to another. What does a low-paid truck driver make, and what does a high-paid truck driver make?
So the average, if you're hauling, say, freight in a freight box, the average annual wage is about $35,000 a year, which is not very much. That's somebody who's not home for months at a time. If you get into certain specialties, then you can go up to maybe a couple of $100,000. But most people are stuck down there in that bottom part. And yes, there is this whole hierarchy depending on the kind of commodities that we haul. So I'm a mover, So I'm called a bed bugger. And then if you haul hazardous materials, you're called a thermos bottle holder. If you haul double trailers, you're called a wiggle wagon. And if you haul live animals, you're called a chicken choker.
And often you're not at the cool kids table at a truck stop.
I'm not at the cool kids table. We have to load and unload our trucks. We have to empty out the house of furniture. We have to be diplomatic and skillful with the people that are moving, who are usually very stressed out. And we make a lot more money than the regular drivers. So, yeah, we're not at the cool kids table. And we don't have chromed out, you know, light trucks with really cool lights. We call those rooster wagons.
Rooster wagons. I like that. You know, so much of truck driving, whether the songs that have been written about it, movies that have been made about trucking, sort of gives it this American cowboy mythology. You kind of put a little bit of that to rest, don't you?
Well, I tried to. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book, because the trucking cowboy myth, the Go West Young Man myth, the on the road trip myth, you know, these are etched into the American myth, and it doesn't really have a lot to do with what I do every day. And so I was looking for some reasonably literate book to read about this, and there wasn't anything there. So I thought, what the heck, I'll give it a try.
How long did it take you to write?
It depends on where you define it. So I started doing, at the end of a day, I started talking into an audio cassette recorder. I did started doing this in the 80s. And then these tapes started to accumulate and accumulate. And then about 4 years ago, I got serious, had the tapes transcribed, had about 800 pages of a whole mess of stuff, and then turned that into some kind of a narrative.
I like that you alternate between stories, and you get kind of philosophical about a lot of different things. One of them is the nature of people, and you see them at their most vulnerable when they're moving and they're exposing their contents of their home to strangers. You also get kind of philosophical about the kind of people who choose trucking, including yourself, as their career. But you've also seen some stuff that's really kind of unsavory, yet you stick with it.
Well, that's because I've always had a taste for low company. That's probably why. I do see some unsavory things, and I do have a few things to say about by moving people and moving all their possessions all the time, I get to see this huge cross-section of people and how they deal with their stuff. And, you know, whether they deal with that wisely or unwisely, you know, for their own life, and it's a lesson for my life in terms of how I deal with my stuff. And well, here's what I say in the book is that all movers are Buddhists, in that we understand the transitory nature of man-made things. And it would be a lot of people that I move don't necessarily understand that. And they get hung up on their things. And it's all going to get thrown away. And this is the odd part. You know, your high school yearbook, the kids' kindergarten drawings on the wall, Aunt Tilly's antique vanity. This stuff doesn't last because I'm the guy who throws it away at the end.
What is the worst experience you've had with a person who's moving, a shipper?
Yeah, so the people we're moving, we call them shippers. A big part of my job is to try to help them navigate this transition from one new house to another house. And people aren't necessarily at their best on moving day because of the whole, you know, it's tough for families, it's tough for spouses, it's tough for children who are switching schools and people are going to new places. So sometimes the movers get the whole brunt of that. And then there's a whole class thing involved in this. This is a working manual labor job. And certain people, you know, devalue manual laborers for reasons best known to themselves. And we don't really like that. And a lot of the people that I work with, because I have to hire crews to load and unload the trucks and empty out these houses. And most of the people I work with are immigrants, mostly Hispanic, mostly new people to the country. A generation ago, the movers were all Irish and Italians, and then it was African Americans, and now it's Hispanics. And, you know, whether you can speak English or not, you certainly understand if you're being treated disrespectfully, and so do I. So the worst things is when we're treated that way, when we're not allowed, say, to use a bathroom, or we're not, you know, somebody goes out and gets a whole bunch of food for the people in the house and they just leave the movers alone. If personal possessions are really important to you, as they are disproportionately for the people that I work with, then, you know, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to to treat your movers who hold all of your stuff that you value disrespectfully.
Didn't one of those people videotape everything you did one day?
So I had somebody videotape all the condition of all the furniture at the Origin, and then videotaped everything as we were unloading it, and then making all these notes about all of this phantom damage. And a lot of people use the moving experience and the insurance to pad the moving expense. And then against that, though, I mean, I've broken a lot of things. I've lost a lot of things. I've destroyed some things. Moving is, you increase your risk profile when you move things. And, I've been responsible for my own share of damage.
It's a risk when you move.
It's a risk if you move. You want to leave the grand piano in the living room. Been there for 30 years. It's great. You want to move it, you're taking a risk. And of course, I'm the one who's taking the risk. And in fact, I've got a story in the book. We're going to get to that. Yes.
Well, why don't you tell it? It's kind of cringeworthy. I'm trying to decide whether to bring it up. But you got to a home with a precious,
beloved family heirloom. Yes. So here's a little piece of moving advice. When the movers come in, do not say to the mover, "This is my most treasured possession, so please take care of it." That's like the kiss of death.
You're blushing now. Even the thought of this experience, and even after writing about it, it still gets to you, doesn't it?
It still gets to me. So
we're trying
to move this grand piano, and the inside stairway had a turn on it, so we couldn't do it that way. So there was an outdoor stairway going up to a deck, and there was only a couple joist hangers holding the stairs up together, and when we got the piano to the top, the whole stairway gave away. The piano dropped 14 feet down onto the ground, made this big giant chord sound like a death flurry, and me and my crew and the shipper and the shipper's family, we all just stared at this piece of matchsticks now with the sort of end of the chord at the end. And all of us we all just started crying and just sort of held on to each other. And it was a poignant, sad moment that still just really gets me.
And it sounds like something in a Steve Martin movie or something like that.
Except it's not funny.
At the end it turned out okay, didn't it?
It did turn out okay because then it started raining. And then the thunderstorm opened, and we're all sort of standing there. Everybody's dabbing at their eyes, looking at this destroyed piano. And then the thunderstorm came down, and then it all started raining, and then we all started laughing. So we understood.
How about your favorite shipper? Who's the person you're just so happy you met that person? You got to move that person.
Oh, one of my favorites was a doctor. He was from Bangladesh. He lived in the Bronx. He was moving out to Utah. He wanted to become a cowboy. And he was an OBGYN, and he had come to America. He spent 5 years as a taxi driver. He had a medical degree in Bangladesh, but it's different. Then he went back to medical school, got his American MD, and then moved out to Utah, bought this 10-acre ranch, and started learning how to ride a horse and just – he was really living the American dream that he'd read about in Westerns when he was a kid.
Is this the one who built himself a 10-bedroom house?
No, that's a different guy. The guy that moved into the 10-bedroom house with the 11 bathrooms and wouldn't allow us to use any of them.
Okay. So this is the one that you suspect probably wanted to take on some extra wives once he got to his new.
Yeah, he moved up to the, plural marriage place there in between Arizona and Utah. He thought he could start bringing his wives over from Bangladesh, and it would just fit right in with the whole rest of the group.
So, Finn, when we're all driving down the highway and we see tractor-trailer trucks go by us, do all these truckers have the same kind of stories you do, or just the movers?
I see. This is part of that whole hierarchy thing. I like to think the movers are a little more polished because we have to have these diplomatic skills. But it would be a mistake to think that truckers are this, harmonized group of redneck simians. It's very diverse, and in different parts of the country, it gets sort of different, and then sort of the same. Like in California, there's the Sikhs from India. There's zillions of Sikh truck drivers in California, just to say. And then in Texas, there's zillions of Hispanic truck drivers, and then it varies from place to place. But and there's way more women now than there used to be. So a lot of husband and wife teams that you didn't used to see before. And then there's just, you know, regular working folks. So it's not, you know, that Southern rebel kind of guy. It's not that cowboy guy with the big belt buckle. I mean, those guys, they're there, but that's not all of us. There's 3 million of us.
Yeah, I read this morning, 3 million truckers in America, people with, the right driver's license working on the road. That's a lot of people, a huge variety. How many of them you think listen to NPR?
I think every trucker I've ever talked to listens to NPR. And now people are always asking me why I think that is. I mean, it's not scientific. But here's the thing. When you're going through – just use Maine as an example. You can go from Calais down to Kittery, and you can pick up a station as you're traveling. And that's a huge thing because when you're in the truck, you know, doing 60 miles – per hour, so I'm losing signals all the time. And with the National Public Radio Network, you can stay with the signal. So even – and this is sort of funny. So even if you're with a program that you don't necessarily like, you're going to stay there for the continuity. And there's so many different – I mean, I hear this all the time. Oh, well, truck drivers wouldn't listen to NPR because of X. But there's so much variety. I mean, you can hate Fresh Air and love – Wait, don't tell me. It doesn't matter.
Well, I agree. So if we were to go to any truck stop in America and eavesdrop, we'd hear conversations about what people heard on NPR.
You would. And you'd hear arguments, too, and differences of opinion. But the funny part is they're listening. They may not have the coffee mug. Who knows? That's what they wanted to know when I talked to the people at NPR in Washington, because they were very surprised. They said, truckers listen to NPR, but we don't really know that. And I said, well, you know, I don't know what scientifically, but I just know talking to the guys. But I don't know if, you know, when it's pledge week, if they're giving it, you know, getting the T-shirt.
Now, you went to Colby undergrad.
I did 3 years at Colby College.
You were on your way to having this elite, well-respected education, and you gave it up.
It was not a popular decision in my family, believe me, at that time. And I discussed that in the book. I finished 3 years. I was a German literature major at Colby, and as I said, I was doing summer work as a mover. And at the end of my third summer, I took a road trip with a long haul driver down to Virginia from Connecticut, and that was it. I decided I wasn't going to go back and finish college, and I've been doing this ever since, on and off.
Have your parents recovered?
Yeah, so they erased my name from the family Bible for a time. Now, my name's back in the family Bible, but it's kind of in pencil. I come from this huge – so I have 7 brothers and sisters. We come from this sort of typical Irish Catholic family, and you were supposed to go to college, and you weren't supposed to turn that down.
Well, Finn Murphy, this is a lot of fun. We do have to take our first break. If you have a question about life on the road, about Finn Murphy's experiences, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. And if you're one of those truckers listening to NPR right now, why don't you join the conversation? You can send an email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post to our Facebook page. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible. As do Ocean View at Falmouth, committed to sustainability and dedicated to offering active retirement living with peace of mind for the future. And the University of Maine, hosting Bill Green in conversation with NPR's Brian Naylor November 9th in Orono. Free tickets at collinscenterforthearts.com. Maine Public Radio is your station. Financial contributions from listeners like you keep Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical on the air across the state. New programs, longtime favorites, it's all literally made possible by you. You make sure we have access to trusted programs from NPR, the BBC, and others. You bring the local news from the Maine Public News team. You produce every episode of Maine Calling. And it's a two-way street. When you pledge your financial support, Public Radio is there for you. So please do your part to keep this crucial service running. It's a win-win for everybody. Do your part on this Super Thursday or right now. Call at 800-866-1475 or donate online at mainpublic.org. Thank you. A reminder that today is Election Day. And this evening, all of our services, Maine Public Radio, television, and online at mainpublic.org, will offer periodic updates of the voting results as they come in, starting at 8 o'clock this evening. We'll follow the 4th statewide referendum questions, as well as notable local issues such as rent control in Portland and the proposed merger between Lewiston and Auburn. And of course, we will report the final results with analysis tomorrow on Morning Edition, Here and Now, and All Things Considered.
Third boxcar, midnight train, destination Bangor, Maine. Wool, worn out suit and shoes. I don't pay no union dues. I smoke.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I never realized in King of the Road that he mispronounces Bangor, Maine, and calls it Bangor, Maine. That's terrible. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, behind the wheel of an 18-wheeler, we're talking about life on the road. With me in the studio, Finn Murphy. He grew up in Connecticut, now lives in Colorado. He started working as a long-haul trucker in 1980 and is the author of the new book, The Long Haul. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Finn, before we go to the calls, I've got to ask you, you've done for the world of trucking kind of what Anthony Bourdain did for the restaurant world, and maybe spilled a few secrets. So I'm wondering what kind of reaction you've had from other truckers.
I have spilled a few secrets for both the trucking industry and for the moving industry. And universally, the drivers that I talk to, they're all very happy to be recognized as the hardworking folks that they are. And a lot of people that have moved are really happy to have an inside view of what happens on the other side of their move. Because a lot of people, the moving industry is opaque, and now it's a little less opaque.
Carson on Facebook asks, what is the scariest thing that has happened to you on the road? Listening in now with my friend.
The scariest thing is always driving in the ice and snow in the mountains. And the mountains can be, you know, anywhere. You've got, big mountains in Massachusetts, believe it or not, out on Route 2. You've got the Rocky Mountains. You've got, Western North Carolina. It's always snow, ice, and the big truck.
Okay. Owen has an email. He asks, what's the ratio of male to female drivers? How is the culture around female truckers different or the same as male truckers?
So it's 7% females, 93% males, and that number's been going way up. It might have doubled even in the last few years from maybe 3.5. What you're seeing now is a lot of more husband and wife teams. As lower-skilled work around the country gets downsized, which is happening continually, a lot of people are moving into trucking, and a lot of couples are moving into trucking. So it's really made life a lot better in the truck stops, for example. Whenever there's women around, men tend to behave slightly better, and the bathrooms are cleaner, and the truck stop experience is better.
All right. We'll go to Mike calling from Madawaska. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
I had a question. When I was out west, a couple of friends taxied around the country to go to various musical concerts.
Mike, we're having a really hard time understanding you. It'd be great if you could try to call back, maybe from a different location or on a landline. We're going to move on to Kevin calling from Brunswick. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. What a great program. And I would like, this is a quick story. I'll make it as quick as I can. I was a bed bugger for 21 years. And me and my wife started when I was 22. She was 21. We lived in San Diego, California. We bought our first truck when I was 22 in 1974. Our very first trip, we got a load going to Maine. We came up here over the years. We came back and forth during when the Cold War was hot, delivering to Loring, Pease, Brunswick, Cutler, and then moving people in and out for the paper mills. We fell in love with Maine. The roads were always cleared when the weather was bad, and we loved it. And so when we retired 3 years ago, we had a little business. We sold it, and the ink wasn't dry on the paper, and my wife says, we are moving to Maine. And that is how we landed up in Maine, is through being a bed bugger.
Well, Kevin, thanks for sharing your story. You said you owned your own truck. That's unusual, isn't it?
Yeah, no. I was always an owner-operator. I never drove anybody else's truck. Back in the day, that's how they did it. You, you bought a truck and then you leased your services to a company. And that business taught me everything. I mean, it taught you punctuality, how to deal with customers, customer service. It taught you everything. And I tell people I would not take $1 million for the years I spent in that. And let me say one more thing. When I used to fuel up, I would see people in motorhomes buying fuel for these giant motorhomes. And I would say, listen, if you want to see this country inside and out, jump on a moving van for 10 years because you'll see every Hollywood, Ranchos Palos Verdes, and every ghetto in the country, and that'll teach you about the United States. And thank you for your time.
Kevin, thanks for joining the conversation. Thoughts, Finn?
Yeah, Kevin, I love that point about you'll see everything because movers don't go from terminal to terminal. We don't live on the interstates in the way that a freight hauler does. We go where the moves go, which is towns. We go into towns. We go into communities. We get to see all these places where people are moving. And that's one of the things that just makes it a great experience. And I love that what Kevin said about owning his own truck. So I'm the same way. I actually lease my truck, but that's how the moving industry always worked. So I have a payment. I pay $4,000 a month for my lease, so I have to keep out there, keep working. Mm. So, Kevin, thanks for your service, and lift with your legs.
Speaking of lifting with your legs, Finn, how long are you going to do this?
Well, I'm 59 now. I don't carry as much as I used to. I definitely use more. I use more help than I used to, but as long as I still like it.
Okay, that sounds like a very Tom Brady answer.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go to Mike in Madawaska again. Hi, Mike. Hope we can hear you this time.
Yeah, sorry about that. I dropped into a little hall over there. So I used to have some friends that would travel to music concerts around the country, and they said that they would, the way they'd get there was by truckers. More specifically, a group of Christian truckers never really quite got the specific to that. I didn't know if that was still a thing, if truckers still pick up people to give them rides to places.
I think that's an indication of how diverse the truck drivers are. So there's a whole phalanx of Christian truckers. There's a whole phalanx of you know, various different types of people. I don't. When you say going around to different music events, you must be talking about the Grateful Dead or Fish, I would imagine. I actually saw Grateful Dead at the Cumberland County Civic Center. I don't pick up hitchhikers. I don't see hitchhikers out there in the truck stops. If that's something that they're doing, it's something they're arranging ahead of time.
Mike, thanks for your call. We've got another Mike, this one calling from Acton. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi. Your experience absolutely mirrors mine. I was a bored college student in Towson, Maryland at Towson University, started working for a local mover, and then the next thing you know, I'm out there bed-bugging with the best of them, and 17-year career, and in the middle of all that, I ended up hooking up with a sound and light company out of Dallas, Texas, and I started hauling rock and roll bands and traveled all of Canada and Mexico, parts of Mexico. Was a wonderful experience, and being a mover, you're right on with what you say about the handling. You're not just a performing a service of moving stuff. You are hand-holding, et cetera. It's a much different experience than hauling dry freight, swinging meat, what have you. But I just wanted to let you know that it was absolutely astounding when I heard how you got into trucking. It was exactly what my experience was, too, because on the other hand, everybody in my family for the last five generations had gone to college. I was the first one to say, no, this isn't for me.
Hey, Mike, so anyway, you know what? We also have a tweet from Jason who asked, do you run into many other truckers who quit a prestigious college for trucker? The reason I ask is my son did this, too. Is there a whole gang of you out there?
Apparently there is. It's nice to know. I wonder, so movers are called bedbuggers. I wonder what the swinging meat people, they must have a nickname too, but I don't know what it is. So anybody knows that out there, let us know.
Mike, thanks for your call. We'll move on to Selby, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Selby. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. Great show as usual. I have a question that's a little bit on the darker side with trucking. I understand that commercial truck stops can be places where there have been reports of human sex trafficking and with children and foreign nationals, et cetera. And I'm wondering if your guest has ever encountered that, and if there is any association of truckers that works to report that, or, you know, in some way combat that taking place at commercial truck stops.
Yes, and I have seen that. There's a certain amount of prostitution. There's a certain amount of human trafficking that you see. There's also a certain amount of human trafficking in terms of carrying people around in the truck. There was that incident about a month ago in Texas when those people died in the back of that tractor trailer. Let's put it this way. It's around, but it's not ubiquitous. What I've noticed is there's a particular truck stop that's just east of Los Angeles. There's one outside of Chicago. There's some very bad places that I avoid, and then there's other ones. But trucking's been cleaned up a lot since mandatory drug testing has really helped clean things up. All of the drivers complain about the regulatory environment, but that's helped clean things up. So it's definitely out there, but not, you know, everywhere. And there is an organization of truck drivers who do report this, and I can't remember what the name of it is.
Selby, thanks for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can email us at talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Speaking of regulations, Finn, I'm wondering how much things like GPS trackers have changed the industry. You know, I'm guessing just like UPS drivers, many trucking companies know exactly where their truck drivers are at every moment.
And they know how they're braking and how they're accelerating and how they're using fuel efficiency and when they're sleeping. Some freight companies have 24/7 video in the cab. And then you've got GPS with respect to figuring out where you're going. And then so they'll have something to say about routes. This is one of the myths that I try to dispel just a little bit when you talk about the free-range cowboy trucker. This is one of the most regulated industries in the United States. They know everything we're doing at every time, at every moment. And so let's put it this way. Trucking is a lot more like 1984 than 1894. They know everything.
John tweets and asks us, what do you think of the TV show Shipping Wars? Is it realistic?
I love Shipping Wars. Yes, it is realistic in one sense, at least. Everybody's bidding everybody else down to get some work. That's what you see in Shipping Wars. And you see that the least experienced people are the one who take the biggest financial hit. And that's a good economics lesson for anybody in trucking or anybody opening a hot dog stand, actually.
We have an email from Mimi. The fellows who moved me to Maine 23 years ago were wonderful. They moved heirlooms and a Steinway grand piano and endless boxes of books with cheer and energy. They also bought lunch for me when they went out for takeout, and they did not charge me for the extra weight that was miscalculated by the guy who does the calculating. Can't wait to read the book. So there, Mimi's on your side, Finn.
Thank you, Mimi. Obviously, it wasn't me who moved you.
Okay, email from Kathy. A friend of mine, a guy who once worked for once. Let me start over. A friend of mine, a guy, once worked for a mover. When they stopped at a truck stop with their big hauler, my friend ordered tea at the trucker counter. When they got back in the truck, his boss said, "Never do that to me again." Still true? Is coffee the only acceptable beverage?
Coffee is still the only acceptable beverage, and the whole culture has changed because you can't smoke at the coffee counters anymore. That was a big thing. You know, you'd be eating a cheeseburger next to a trucker, and there'd be one on either side, and then you'd be blowing all your smoke into your cheeseburger. So that's been cleaned up quite a bit. Yes, but you would not order tea. No, sorry.
Okay, another secret. We're going to take another quick break, but before we do, a word about tomorrow's program. We're going to learn about attempts to bridge the partisan divide in our country. We're very interested in hearing your thoughts on how to get people from different political beliefs really talking and listening to each other. Email your thoughts to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet us, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com. Maine Audubon, a community of people who understand that when Maine's wildlife thrives, Maine thrives. Learn more at maineaudubon.org. And the DePonte String Quartet, performing Mozart, Bartok, and Brahms, with concerts November 4th through the 12th. Tickets at deponte.org.
Hello, I'm Tom Ashbrook, host of NPR's On Point. I'm asking you to contribute to the radio service that gives you the information that helps you make better decisions, develop more informed opinions, have a more enriched and fulfilling life. I'm asking you to give back to the radio service that helps you live your life as an informed, active, and effective member of your community. Maine Public Radio provides you information so you can make sense of what's going on. You have the chance to see how an issue looks from other perspectives. You can give back by contributing whatever you can. Call now with your pledge and it will be counted toward the Super Thursday one-day membership drive. Please take a moment right now and call 1-800-866-1475 or go to mainepublic.org.
Super Thursday is this Thursday, November 9th. On the next Speaking in Maine, the 2017 Mitchell Lecture on Sustainability.
We tend to hang out with people who think the way we do.
All Americans need to redouble their efforts to work to understand the views of those who think differently.
Ecologist and sociologist Tom Dietz weighs on the importance of facts and values, and former Senator George Mitchell considers the current state of environmental issues in politics. You can hear the discussion on Speaking in Maine, Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
Is that, Roddy, a remix of the original Convoy? Oh, my gosh. Anyway, welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling today on the program, The Life of a Long Haul Trucker. Joining me today, Finn Murphy, who is the author of The Long Haul, which is about his life behind the wheel. Finn attended Colby College. He's been a long haul trucker since 1980. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Finn, Elizabeth by email wants to ask a question. I was going to ask you anyway. What do truckers wish car drivers would do differently? What don't automobile drivers know about driving around trucks? I'm always very careful not to cut right in front of a truck. I know that much. What else should we know?
Two things. First thing is merging. So when you're merging onto the highway, you're coming to my house for my party. So that means you have to knock on the door and ask to be let in. We can't always make the space for you. So that would be one. And cars can accelerate and decelerate a lot faster. So it's just get in. And then the second one is when you're passing a truck, pass it quickly, get it done. Don't hang out by those wheels. Because the thing that I'm most afraid of out there on the road is a front wheel blowout. And if my tire blows out, my left tire blows out, I'm going into that other lane. So you don't want to be in that mix. So both things, it's actually the same answer, which is make your decision, execute it.
Okay. We'll go to Jimmy calling from Orono. Hi, Jimmy. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Hi, Finn. Great show. First question, what about tires? You see a lot of, I think you call them gatorbacks on the roads, and it seems like tires should be better designed today so that there aren't so many tread separations and failures. And my second question, Finn, is New England rest area. So I often, when I travel, sleep in the back of our van, and I'm wondering if you've heard any stories of whether that's safe or unsafe to sleep in a passenger vehicle in rest areas in New England. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So we call them gators. They sort of look like the alligator back. That's a tire retread that's come off, that's separated from itself. I don't use retreads on any of my trucks, and our company that I contract to doesn't use them either. So yeah, and they're really, really dangerous. So the thing is, a lot of people are at the very, you know, they're at the breadline with respect to, you know, their income and their expenses. So they're trying to save money by buying cheaper tires. And then as I sleep in rest areas all the time, I don't really have any problems with it. Again, it's sort of like truck stops. There's a couple of notorious rest areas. The Vince Lombardi rest area just on the other side of the George Washington Bridge. That's called a pickle park. I think we want to avoid that. But no, it's especially in New England, I don't see any problems at all.
All right. We'll go to Anthony calling from Arundel. Hi, Anthony. Go ahead.
Yes. I had a question because of the program name of Life on the Road. I'd like to hear a day in the life of a trucker, from when they get up in the morning, what they eat, how they bathe, you know, what they do for lunch, and what their general day looks like.
Okay, well, it kind of depends, doesn't it?
It sort of does. But so I spend most of my nights in my truck. So I wake up and take care of certain some physical requirements, which I'm going to do in various ways. If I'm in a truck stop, I'll use the men's room or a rest area. I also have a Gatorade bottle in the back of my truck. I'll brush my teeth. I'll wash my face. I'll do my pre-trip inspection. And if I'm driving that day, then I'll change my clothes and drive. It's I don't necessarily get to take a shower every day. And I don't really have great food choices because the truck's so big, I'm pretty much relegated to truck stops, which means I eat a lot of Subway. And then I'll start the truck and move on. And what I'll do is I listen to a lot of audiobooks. I listen to a lot of NPR. I listen to a lot of podcasts. I haven't done Sirius XM yet.
Okay. Well, Anthony, you know, it's funny you mentioned you eat a lot of Subway because we have an email from Becca. She says, "Hi, Finn. Do truck stops really have the best food or is that a myth?" And then it says your friends Peter and Becca from ACK.
Okay. Hello, Peter and Becca.
What's ACK?
Nantucket.
Okay.
The truck stops have been closing down their restaurants all over the place. Especially so, and there's been this huge consolidation. So you've got Pilot Flying J, then you've got TA Petro. Those are the two big truck stop operators. One of the nice things about trucking in New England is you still have some small independents. Like you got Dysart's up there in Bangor, which is world famous. All these Canadian truckers. I mean, it's French. You hear more French in Dysart's than you hear English, and they still have a restaurant. But no, it is. I think it's always been a myth, unless fine dining is chip beef on toast and meatloaf with mashed potatoes. But I'm not to disparage those. I love those two things. But it's getting harder and harder to find that.
A whole lot of – we've got two emails and on the same subject. Isaac, I'll ask his question. Are you worried that self-driving cars will end trucking careers? I guess really what he means is self-driving trucks.
So I don't think we've ever seen anything like this in our lifetimes. You've got 7 or 8 of the wealthiest, most aggressive companies on the planet racing each other for this. You've got Apple, Alphabet, Amazon, Daimler-Benz, Tesla, all of these companies are racing each other to get the driverless vehicle. So it's my view is it's going to happen. It's going to happen way sooner than we think. And I'm very ambivalent about it. I mean, you've got a few million truckers that will be probably out of a job before we even understand why, on the one hand. And then on the other hand, you know, there's 41,000 traffic deaths in America every year on the highways. That's a bloodbath. And we're so used to that number, we don't really think about it. But what if the driverless vehicles took that 41,000 figure down to, say, a couple hundred, and all these people aren't getting killed on the roads? And it's going to be different. It's going to be another huge cultural revolution in American life or the world's life. 30 years from now, we're not going to be allowed to drive our own cars because it's going to be considered too barbarous and dangerous.
Sure. I've told my kids, you're going to tell your kids, I used to have to take this thing called driver's ed.
Yeah, they're going to say, you had a pedal on the floor that made the thing stop and go? How archaic.
Be collector's items. We'll go to Carrie in West Baldwin. Hi, Carrie. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm a trucker's wife, and he's out on the road for 3 or 4 weeks at a time. And I just wanted to say that a lot of those 3 million drivers do have family at home, and we do support our family members who are out driving and really like what you said about how to help keep them safe.
Thank you. That's something that I wanted – a point I definitely wanted to make too. You know, we're not a bunch of these crazed predators out there. We're just regular Americans. We have aspirations. We have families. We have emotional lives. And, you know, sometimes when we're out there with that big machine, you know, sometimes we might be scared and we might be nervous and we might be distracted with what's going on at home. So it would be nice to, for people to remember that.
Carrie, thanks for your call. You've got an interesting vantage point up there in a cab. How often are you looking down at people texting?
I'm always looking. It's funny. I've got this peripheral vision that I can see everything that's going on in a car. And that's the first thing anybody who's driving a four-wheeler should remember, is that we can see everything that's going on in there. So this is not a private space. It's got windows all around it, and we're way up high. I think American drivers in general, I think they're pretty good. But they're courteous in general and skillful. But if we all just drove while we were driving instead of driving while doing something else, we'd all be better. And so you see texting, you see people putting on makeup, you see people eating, you see people drinking, disciplining the kids in the back seat's a big one. And but the biggest one, I think, is working on the relationship with the person in the passenger seat. That seems to be what all Americans are doing all the time. Sometimes you see a relationship working really well and you see a romantic moment, which is also distracting. But most of the time, it's conflict.
This is a family show. We're going to go to Ray calling from Elliot. Hi, Ray. Go ahead.
Hi, Finn. I really enjoyed your book. And you talk in there about how there are people that denigrate movers and look down upon the Hispanic helpers and so forth. And I enjoyed the section in the chapter Invisible Men where you talk about how you got back at Mr. Big, you know, because you did mention there are ways you can seek revenge on people. But I thought that was very interesting. And and the other thing I found interesting was a story about, I don't want to go into detail and ruin it for other people, but that one move you made west for the woman in Connecticut that hadn't been there that long, and she and her son were going to follow you out. And I thought that was a very touching part of the book, but that's all I wanted to say.
Well, thank you. But what I like about this, about doing this kind of work, is the interactions that I get with people that I'm moving, with the families that I'm moving, and with the people that I'm working with. And it is an interesting vantage point because I work for the wealthiest people in the nation, and I work with the poorest people in the nation, and I sort of get to sit there and watch that happen. It's fascinating.
Thanks for your call, Ray. We'll go to James calling from Portsmouth. Hi, James. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is James. I'm actually really excited. I've never been on a radio talk show before. But Finn, I haven't read your book, but I'm actually very excited to look into it. I have a story that's a little similar. I fell ill to the opioid epidemic at a young point in my life, and I was actually about to graduate from pharmacy school, and I was in my last 6 weeks of getting my doctorate of pharmacy. And I was, you know, under the grips of addiction, and I got caught, and I got into a lot of trouble. And the media basically made me, you know, the case study, and I was all over, you know, different papers and all this stuff. So it was really hard for me to find a job when I finally climbed my way out of, you know, that addiction phase. And, you know, one of the first jobs that I got was actually for a moving company based out of California called Skinny Wimp Moving Company. And, you know, I'm really enjoying this whole set that we've been talking about because, you know, it really is the truth where, you know, you get these people that work so hard and, you know, they go into your lives and they see how other people live and they basically work, you know, the American way. They basically work with their hands. It's blue collar work and it's hard and they get paid nothing, but you know, it is enjoyable work. You get to, you know, work with people, you get to meet all kinds of different people, and you also get to work with all kinds of different people. And I just, thinking back now, you know, I it was an opportunity that changed my life, and it showed me, you know, how to be responsible and how to lead a team. And it just helped me a lot in my personal life. So I just, you know, I appreciate this segment, and I can't wait to read your book.
James, thanks for sharing your story, and congratulations on coming clean. Quite a story. Thank you for sharing. We'll move on to Sandy from Bangor. Hi, Sandy. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to point out that even though I'm talking on the phone headed to Bangor, it's my husband that's driving. So I have a question for Finn. and the big holidays like his birthday and Christmas, I want to know about how many gift certificates for Dunkin' Donuts does he get? And I have two nephews that are truckers. I was thinking about giving them a Dunkin' Donuts gift certificate, but now I'm definitely looking for this book. I've enjoyed this program so much and hearing his stories.
So, Sandy, are you looking for recommendations for gifts for truckers for Christmas?
Well, no, I'm just wondering about how many gift certificates Finn gets to Dunkin' Donuts or other coffee places where they're truckers. That's the first thing that might come to mind is a gift certificate for coffee.
That's a good one.
Yeah, do you get inundated with these gift certificates?
No, I actually don't because I can't go to most of these places because I can't park there. So that's the bane of my life is trying to figure out where to put this truck. But if you wanted to get me a present, here's what I want. I'd like you to go down to your independent bookstore and buy a gift certificate for an audiobook. I could really use those.
Lots of audiobooks. Do you listen? So you listen the tapes still, or do you download them onto your smartphone? How do you listen?
So there's a company called Libro FM, and they are an audiobook download company. But they work differently than other companies in that Libro FM gives a piece of the sale to your local independent bookstore. So that's the one that I use because I love local independent bookstores. So that's it's a download. I also have some tapes, not tapes anymore, some CDs, but mostly downloads now.
All right. Well, Sandy, thanks for your call. Finn, we just have a few seconds left. Thoughts? What would you like the rest of us to take away from knowing you through your book and your conversation?
When I cross I'm going to pronounce this wrong. Is it the Piscataqua River Bridge?
Piscataqua.
I did cross the Piscataqua because I wanted to cross the Route 1 bridge, but it's under construction because there used to be a big truck stop there called Hanscom's, which is still there. But then Hal's truck stop in Kittery, Maine is closed. But wonderful to be in Maine. Great drivers in Maine. Second best in the country after Michigan.
What?
Yes. I know.
Oh, my goodness. I can't excoriate you because we're out of time. So I have to just say thank you for joining us. Finn Murphy lives in Colorado and started working as a long haul trucker in 1980. We have been discussing his new book, The Long Haul. And for those in the Portland area, Finn will be at Print, a bookstore, this evening from 7 to 8. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. Owen Manahan answered your calls. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and by Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, Bridging the Political Divide. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.